Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
And we turn now to Nevada, where last night Scott Dozier would have become the first death row inmate in the U.S. to be executed using the synthetic opioid fentanyl, an execution he very much wanted. He's been on death row for 11 years. But yesterday at the 11th hour, after Alvogen, the maker of the sedative to be used, accused Nevada of illegally securing the drug, a judge blocked Dozier's request to die. Maurice Sharma is a staff writer for the Marshall Project, a nonprofit covering the criminal justice system. He's been speaking with Scott Dozier, including when an execution date was postponed last November. So, Maurice, you probably know how he's feeling now.
The first time that I talked to Scott Dozier, it was after he had discovered that his execution was going to be halted 4 or 5 days ahead of time. So he had sort of ample time to process that, and he was still kind of devastated and dismayed and depressed about it, not really for himself so much as worrying about the kind of whiplash effect on his family members who have sort of gone through a lot with this. And I'm sure there's some relief for the family members, but for Scott himself, he is very ready for this to be over with.
Well, and perhaps his victims' families will as well. Mm. I mean, horrific deaths, murders that he's accused of, one, of course, that he is on death row for. Just tell us, who is Scott Dozier?
He came from a kind of middle-class upbringing and then made his way into the world of the meth trade, has sort of elements of Breaking Bad, in that he sort of got deeper and deeper into this world and more into a world of violence, and eventually was convicted of two separate very grisly murders of people who are also involved in the drug trade. The case for which he's on death row was the murder of a 22-year-old named Jeremiah Miller. The argument the prosecutors made was that Dozier lured Miller with the promise of money and help with making methamphetamine and getting ingredients to make it, and then murdered him. And Dozier has not admitted to that or any other murder explicitly. He kind of sometimes offers sort of cryptic comments around his role. But a couple of years ago, he decided that rather than continue to appeal this case, you know, on into the future, he wanted to be done with it. He felt that living on death row wasn't really living, and that he didn't want to sort of stare down the rest of his life in solitary confinement. And so he decided to forego his appeals. And the result of this was a kind of scramble by Nevada state officials to put back into motion executions after having not carried one out for more than a decade.
Well, look, we'll talk more about the, you know, mechanics of this, but staying with Scott Dozier, mm-hmm. when you say it had elements of Breaking Bad, it's like a poor man's Breaking Bad, as if Breaking Bad wasn't poor man enough. It just seems so kind of crazy because he's talented. He was an artist. He had a wife and a child, and mm-hmm. they've stuck by him in some ways. I mean, when you spoke to him, did he seem like a monster to you?
No. He is a gregarious and thoughtful and very kind of articulate individual. He loves to talk about a kind of wide variety of subjects. There were times when I was interviewing him where I would just sort of realize that we had drifted away from his case to you know, music or art or some other subject. In his mind, I think he was operating in a world that was outside of the law, and the murders that he committed were in a world of people who sort of know the rules of the game. That's sort of his way of seeing it. And I think that there's a lot of nihilism in that and a sort of amoral view of the world. But I don't think that that necessarily qualifies him as a monster. Mm. And he certainly doesn't come off that way. I mean, there are, of course, possibly sides to him that I've not seen. I only interacted with this man after he's spent more than a decade on in prison and on many of those years on death row. So he's, you know, come to be the sign of philosophical calm presence, but that doesn't mean that he's, you know, always been like that. And
right.
it's hard to know.
Well, and there's no getting around that Jeremiah Miller's body was, you know, beheaded and cut up. I mean, it's just, you know, it is monstrous. But
mm-hmm,
so here you have Scott Dozier giving up his appeal, becoming one in 10 of the 1,400 men and women who've been executed in the last four decades who have abandoned their appeals. You write the legal community calls them volunteers. And mm-hmm. you spoke with someone who came up with kind of a profile of who these people are.
The typical profile of one of these individuals actually comports in a big way. This is according to research by John Bloom at Cornell University that sort of comports with the kind of profile of people who commit suicide in the free world. There's elements of mental illness and substance abuse. Racially, it tends to be white prisoners who give up their appeals in disproportionate numbers. And then other scholars have looked at sort of how these prisoners articulate their desires. So some speak of feeling like it was a just sentence that they were given for the crimes that they committed, and they are at peace with it and just want to sort of fade away with that. Dozier is, I think, a little more rare in that, you know, death row in Nevada is not as onerous as it might be in some other states. And also he has a supportive family around him, which is not always true of men on death row. But in other ways, I think Dozier, you know, says things that comport with what a lot of people say who have given up their appeals in death penalty cases. And it's a rare phenomenon, but it's not nearly as rare as I once thought. You know, as I said, 1 in 10 roughly of the people who have been executed have been in this position.
Well, it's also rare to have an execution in Nevada. How did the state have to scramble to meet his requests?
Nevada has had no sort of imminent plans to, you know, have an active execution schedule. And so shortly after Dozier abandoned his appeals, the state Department of Corrections went to drug companies and started soliciting lethal injection drugs. They, I think, solicited something like 247 different potential sources. None of those drug manufacturers or distributors would give them the drugs. So they went back to the drawing board, and then they emerge with a new and never before used combination of drugs to carry out this lethal injection using fentanyl, the opioid that's better known for its, you know, role in a lot of overdose deaths around the country. Finally, a paralytic called sesatricurium. In the past couple of days, the maker of a new drug that was sort of last minute added into the cocktail, a drug called midazolam, the manufacturer of that drug decided to basically go to court and ask the state not to use the drug, arguing that it had been obtained sort of through illegal or improper means.
Yeah. Well, they were going through dry runs and they were asking other states, you know, how do you do this? Mm-hmm. And it's really odd because you talk to researchers who look at states like this who might have conservative district attorneys mm-hmm. who might send a lot of people to death row, but then you might have attorneys general who don't want to risk other voters by carrying out executions. So you've got a lot of people on death row, but not as many executions. I mean, when people are saying, wait a minute, Nevada, you know, is more conservative, they do send people to death row.
Quite a few.
They just don't, they haven't done the executions. And now, you know, people are saying, well, what they're doing with Scott Dozier, or what they were going to do and what they may ramp up to do in the future, is literally state-assisted suicide.
That's right. That's certainly an argument that defense lawyers have made to me. So defense lawyers are an interesting perspective on this because, you know, they're in the business of defending people on death row to try to keep them from being executed. And so when the person on death row says, you know what, I want to be executed, it puts these defense lawyers in a really weird ethical bind where if they continue to represent them and sort of help the prisoners with that request, they are sort of helping them die. And that's led some of those defense lawyers to say, I'm not going to be involved. There was at least one lawyer who abandoned Scott Dozier's case and said, find someone else to do this. I'm not going to help you go into court and ask to be killed. And there's a sense among a lot of these lawyers that it's something like euthanasia, that in a way it's a state-assisted suicide. I think in some ways also lends to the argument that there's a kind of suicidal aspect to this, even if it's not purely suicide in the traditional sense of that word.
Well, and you write that at one point that he'd been sexually abused as a child?
That's right. So in death penalty cases, it's typical for either at the trial stage or during appeals, you know, investigators to go out and learn everything about the background of the person who's facing the death penalty. The idea being that if you know enough about them, that there might be information that would kind of spark mercy among a jury, right? And in Dozier's case specifically, it came out later in the process on appeal that he had been sexually abused as a young person, and personality disorder to him. Nothing on the scale of the kind of like extreme poverty and child abuse that you hear about in some other death penalty cases. You know, Scott Dozier, I think, is really interested in sort of his own sense of agency, his own kind of personhood. And I think he's really dismissive and skeptical of any sorts of sort of accounts of his life that don't put him squarely in control.
You quote him as saying, "I'm tired of being someone else's pawn. They've spent millions of dollars giving me a death sentence, then millions of dollars not killing me." He says, "It doesn't make any effing sense." You could add, they've also spent millions trying to kill him, trying to set up a system in which to do that. I mean, what do you think happens?
There's this emphasis on this kind of clinical, sterile process of lethal injection, which, you know, existed with little clear legal disturbance for the last 30-plus years. And it was only, you know, a handful of years ago that drug companies really sort of awoke to the use of their drugs in the executions and started putting controls in, spurring the scramble by states to find new drugs. But I think that that chaos all speaks to this larger sort of ambivalence around the distance between actually having this punishment and then really actually carrying it out and killing people.
That's Maurice Chama, staff writer for the Marshall Project. They're the nonprofit that covers the U.S. criminal justice system. Maurice, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.